From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, a look at cinematography with Nestor Almendros, who shot Days of Heaven, Kramer vs. Kramer, Sophie's Choice, and Places in the Heart. Also today, I speak with James Crumley. His detective novels are hard-boiled, but Crumley's characters slug it out far from the big city in his home state of Montana. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward examines the brief history and lasting influence of the Velvet Underground. And book critic John Leonard reviews Children of the Arbat, Anatoly Rybakov's novel set in Stalin's Soviet Union. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Nestor Almendros once made the observation that everything seems more interesting on film than in real life. Those of us who agree should thank cinematographers like Nestor Almendros for making those moving pictures so captivating. Almendros was called one of the greatest directors of photography by the late film director François Truffaut. They made 9 movies together, including The Wild Child and The Last Metro. In the United States, Almendros was the cinematographer for Kramer vs. Kramer, Sophie's Choice, and Places in the Heart. He won an Academy Award for his work on Days of Heaven. Nestor Almendros grew up in Spain. After the fascists won the Civil War, his father went into exile in Cuba and sent for the rest of the family in 1948. Almendros despised the Cuban film industry under Batista and left for France as a young adult, but he returned after the revolution and wrote film criticism and directed about 20 Cuban documentaries. Then he left Cuba again to work in France. He now lives in France, Barcelona, and New York. Almendros has directed a new documentary. It's called Nobody Listened. It's about human rights violations in Cuba under Castro. It features testimony from former political prisoners now living in exile. It's a follow-up to his 1984 documentary on a similar subject called Improper Conduct. Nestor Almendros, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You're really known around the world as a cinematographer, yet you've decided to direct this new documentary, and I'd like to know why you wanted to make this documentary.
Well, first of all, I've directed before. I was a cinematographer. I did many documentaries in Cuba and in France. And this documentary, I made it because I think that what's happening in Cuba, oddly enough, is not well known. I mean, what's happening in Chile, for instance, in South Africa, which is as horrible as it is, at least they have the benefit of having the sympathy of most of the people. But the Cuban subject is ignored, and it's scandalous.
I think you're making the comparison to Stalin in your movie, that the left in America didn't want to recognize the atrocities under Stalin, and I think you're saying that the left in America doesn't want to open its eyes to what's happening in Cuba.
That is true, yes. The left in America is very slow in understanding, although there are people who have changed, like Susan Sontag and other people who remain on the left and have changed. I wouldn't say that all the left is favorable to Castro. They're usually, those who are favorable, they are people who are very misinformed, people who are misinformed, who prefer to dream.
Now, you started your film career in Cuba. You made a lot of state-sponsored documentaries about Cuba when you were there. And then you became disillusioned. What was responsible for that disillusionment?
Well, many little things, of course, and big things at the same time. I mean, you could see that the press was being controlled. Even our filmmaking was totally controlled by the government. We had to make constantly propaganda for the government, you know. But also, the fire squads, the killings. I remember one night I was having dinner on the port of Havana with a group of friends, and I heard at the distance, bang, bang, bang. And I said, what is it? To someone, I said, don't you know? They're killing people in the Cabana Fortress, which is across the bay. And I was paralyzed. I couldn't eat anymore.
So that's part of the reason why you left the country.
Yes. I also knew that if I would stay there, I would end in prison.
You say in your autobiography, which is called, well, it's part autobiography, part about the movies you've made, it's called A Man with a Camera, and you say that in one of Castro's speeches, he condemned one of your movies.
No. He condemned someone else's movie, a movie I had defended, a documentary called PM, which was totally innocuous politically, but it was not produced by the government. And these people were just dismissed. And I was also dismissed as a film critic for having defended the movie.
in your new documentary, the shooting style is very straightforward. You have done some really gorgeous cinematography for narrative movies, and this is very, very straightforwardly done.
Yes, on purpose, yes. Uh-huh. I think there's no room...
Headshots, or talking heads, we'd call it.
Yeah, there's no room for aesthetics in a documentary. I think a good documentary should document and should left aside. I mean, it has to be beautiful, of course, and things have to be seen well, correctly, but there's no room for fireworks in photography or in music. You notice, for instance, that the film has no music in the background, underlining anything.
Sure, because you'd know every trick in the books for making the lighting really dramatic. So if someone's telling a dramatic story about their imprisonment, it would look as dramatic as it sounded, but you don't do any of that.
No, I try to be as normal and as close to the life as possible and see the face as well. I believe that the face, especially the eyes, are like a lie detector. And the more you see it, the better. I mean, the audience has to see that these people are not lying. They're saying an awful truth. And the more you see them, if you start doing arty lighting with half-lit faces, that might be very beautiful, but you don't see the eyes.
You know, I should mention for listeners who want to see your new documentary, Nobody Listened, that it hasn't opened as yet in American theaters, and that's the way it will be shown is still to be determined.
It's been shown in film festivals already, in AFI in Hollywood, Los Angeles, and Houston, where we won the first award for Best Documentary already. And now we're going to Cartagena in South America and Barcelona. But the opening hasn't been established yet as a film.
My guest is cinematographer Nestor Almendros. Now, as you pointed out, this is not the first film that you've directed. And, in fact, you started your career as a film director in Cuba. Why did you switch over to cinematography? Because, let's face it, it's directors that have the most glory as far as the behind-the-scenes people in movies.
Well, because when I arrived in France, exiled from Cuba, with no money, no help, I had to make a living. And I was a director, which was also a photographer. I mean, I was doing cinema verite, handheld camera. So I thought that if I could get people to use me on the professional, on the technical side, that would be easier to break into the business. And so it happened, especially when you are for free, you always find people that want you. And that's how I started the career. And then a career I really didn't think it was going to be my career, because I didn't intend to be a cinematographer. It just went skyrocketing, and then it even brought me to Hollywood.
You know, when I see a movie that I think is beautifully shot, I never really know who I should credit with it, whether it's the director or the cinematographer.
The director, always. The director. I mean, you cannot make good cinematography if you don't have a director behind letting you do it. So ultimately, it belongs to him. And the first question you said before that I forgot to tell you, the second part of it, is that doing cinematography for a man like Truffaut, or for Robert Benton, or Alan Pakula, or now Scorsese, as I'm going to, it's no sacrifice. It's really wonderful to work with a great genius, you know, and there's no regrets about it. It would be terrible if I would make bad movies, but I have made very few bad movies.
So that's really true. Now, you were telling me before that when you decide whether or not you're going to do a film, the first thing you want to know is who's the director.
Exactly. I am a film buff, and I practice La Politique des Auteurs of Cahiers du Cinéma. I believe that the worst film of Buñuel is better than the best film of a mediocre director.
Let's look at a couple of scenes from movies that you've directed and talk about what you did to get that look. Let's start with Days of Heaven. That's the movie that you won your Academy Award for. It's set in the American Midwest during the Depression. And there's a scene in which all the field workers are trying to pick, the locusts have invaded, and they're trying to pick the locusts off the wheat fields. And they're picking them off and then burning them. But for reasons I won't go into, the wheat field catches on fire, and there's a huge fire that engulfs this enormous wheat field. And you have all the characters silhouetted in basically black outline against these wheat fields. It's absolutely stunning. It's very hard, I'm sure, to film a fiery scene like that.
No, it isn't. In fact, first of all, to begin with, we had to have a scene that gave opportunities to the cinematographer to shine. And here was a big fire. It wasn't the script. Terrence Malick had thought about it. He's a sort of a pyroman, do you say, or an arson man?
A pyromaniac?
Yeah, he loves fire, you know. And also, he's a man from the country. He was from Oklahoma and Texas. He knows the fields. He worked in the harvester. So he knows that very well. Now, how you solve that? That's where I come. I believe that very often when you have a fire seen on the movie, they always have arc lights lighting on the dark side. And then by doing that, they destroyed the effect of the fire. I thought that it would be better not to do any lighting and just leave them in silhouette, as you noticed. And it makes like cave painting in a way. And there's a great beauty. Of course, we asked the people to be in profile because that's how you know a little bit who is who.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah, Richard Gere and Brooke Adams, they are in profile and silhouette. So you know who they are. There's a little trick, but we did two takes, one with light, for instance, in that scene, and one without.
One with artificial light.
Yes, just to fill up, you know, so you would read on the faces. I thought that the one in silhouette would be better, and I was glad that Malik chose the one in silhouette.
Now, in the scene, there are sparks flying. It's very smoky. How do you keep a camera lens clean to observe
clean.
All of this?
It isn't clean. The cameras have to be cleaned afterwards. They get dirty. And then we got the smell of a smoke. The fire scene was shot during 10 days. It was, and the film is only 10 minutes perhaps, but it was 10 days. We burned a different field every day, and we were all smoky, and we had goggles to protect ourselves from the smoke. And the cameras, it's a miracle that nothing happened, but they could have been damage, you know. There's always a little bit of risk in that kind of thing.
You said you burned a different wheat field every day. How did you find fields to burn?
Well, that belonged to a religious group called the Uttarites, but they're related to the Memnonites. They have enormous amounts of wheat. They have enormous amounts of field because it's collective ownership. And they just sold it for the price of the harvest. They were very happy. They didn't have to harvest and they got the money from it.
How do you know for sure that a take is going to be good? For instance, in this scene in Days of Heaven where there's fire raging out of control, you'd better know that that take is a good take. You're not going to want to, after the fires are all put out, you're not going to want to do this again.
Well, that's that's the great excitement of films, that you don't know precisely. So when you see the rushes later on a dark room, you're always surprised. It's usually, as we said at the beginning, better than in life. Things always look better in movies. And sometimes you're disappointed, but most of the times it's better.
Cinematographer Nestor Almendros is my guest. Now let's compare what you did on Days of Heaven with another movie that you shot. You shot Kramer versus Kramer. Now, Days of Heaven has obvious opportunities for incredible photography because you're talking about landscape shots, you're talking about period photography, it's made in the Depression. Kramer versus Kramer is a naturalistic movie set in apartment buildings and office buildings, and it's a very, you know,
it's
realistic type of movie.
It's the most difficult thing to do.
Now, I think it would be the other way around.
Movie. The other one is a piece of cake. You know, making a film with landscapes and waterfalls or... they're the films that win Oscars always, and frankly, non-deserved very often. The moment you have a film with thousands of extras, costumes, especially if it's a costume movie in India or in South America or in a period movie like ours, which people were not dressed like today, and you have mountains and fields and clouds, but that's there by Mother Nature. Yet people think, oh, what wonderful photography, and it's the easiest thing of the world. But doing an apartment like in Kramer, every day, you know, everyday banality, get beauty out of it. That's the toughest thing.
Yeah, so what are the challenges shooting Kramer versus Kramer in an apartment building and an office building?
Well, that it has, although it's shot in studio, the apartment of Kramer was built in studio. It's not a real one. It was copied after a real one.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some window scenes that were shot in the real one, but most of the shoot was done there. So to make people feel that they are there, that it's true, that's not a set, that's not fake, you know, that feeling of reality, also of a three-dimensional feeling, especially for night scenes, which are the most difficult to do, that there is a depth, that there's a lamp here and a dark area, and then another, like it happens in life, there's a dark area here and a lighter one there. And then also that the different rooms of an apartment, people are aware of it, that people feel that they could walk into that apartment, that that's not abstract, that it's true, that it could be theirs. And that takes some kind of, you know, engineering. You have to.
Let's look at the actors that you had to shoot in Kramer versus Kramer.
Well, that also, it's the most important film. This kind of movie has an advantage over the other kind, which we said, is that the actors come out wonderfully because they have no competition.
Well, one of the leading actress in it is Meryl Streep, who you also shot in Sophie's Choice.
She was practically discovered in Kramer. I mean, that's what she, it made out of her a star.
Compare how you lit her for Sophie's Choice with how you lit her in Kramer versus Kramer, and why. The different ways you shot
her
in both those films.
Yeah, it's very different. Sophie's Choice is a very stylized movie. Here, it's a period movie, too. It doesn't happen today. It happens after the war.
Right.
So here you have the chance to stylize things because people have forgot how things were. That's the advantage of doing films which are period. Also, you have all those flashbacks in Poland, which allowed us to do also some stylish photography. But in Sophie's, we sort of got ourselves inspired from Technicolor movies of the 50s, you know. The lighting was a little more harsh, bigger shadows, more expressionistic, whereas in Kramer it was more naturalistic.
Mm. When you're arranging the light so that you'll have exactly the kind of effect you want to achieve, then the character's going to move. I mean, is that a problem, that if you want a certain dramatic lighting effect, that they might move the wrong way or move right out of
that
effect?
Well, that's a compromise. In fact, the good way should be let the actors do their number first and then do the lighting.
Mm-hmm.
You don't do the lighting and then you ask them to move into the lights.
So you watch them rehearse first and then
first
figure out how to light it.
First, the director decides where they should do, where they should go. And then I'll come and I'll do some lighting. And sometimes we will tell them, why instead of walking there, don't you walk to the other side so you'll get a better light? And some actors like Meryl Streep, Jack Nicholson, they have a good sense of light. They really know where the light is. Sometimes you don't even have to tell them. They have a tropism, you know. They know where the light is.
Now look at someone like Dustin Hoffman. He's got a very big nose, a kind of unusual face. Does he require a certain kind of lighting?
Well, he is like a chameleon.
Mm-hmm.
You say that?
Chameleon, yeah.
Chameleon, yeah. He can be anything. In Kramer, he's very handsome.
Mm-hmm.
And so is in the first film he made, The Graduate.
Right.
And if he wants to be ugly, then he can be Rizzo in that film.
Midnight Cowboy.
He can be anything he wants, like Meryl Streep, too. Meryl looks very ugly in Ironweed, and she wanted to be. You know, and I thought that we made him look quite good in Kramer. He looks like, I mean, he's not Gary Cooper, but he's an acceptable man, I think.
What do you look at in a face when deciding how you're going to light it?
Well, I belong to the Greek or Roman tradition, so I do have an idea of beauty, which, of course, has to do with that inherited a culture that we have. I mean, if a person has a huge nose, then we'll try to not to show that because the Greeks had that sense of proportion. The mouth could not be that big. The eye, the nose and the eye should be of a good size and the ears also. So I look at that first without any consideration for the light. I try to see the person as you see an animal, not really forgetting that you are a man, you know. And then once you see these defects that the person might have, you try to conceal them with the lighting or with the framing or with the position of the person in front of the camera. You know, if a person has an ugly profile, you'll try not to have this person in profile very often. And if it has a beautiful profile, then it's the opposite, you know.
My guest is Nestor Almendros, and he's one of the most respected cinematographers in the world. His movies include Kramer versus Kramer, Sophie's Choice, The Last Metro, Days of Heaven. We're going to talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Cinematographer Nestor Almendros is my guest. And by the way, his latest movie is actually a documentary that he directed, and it's about human rights violations in Cuba. And it's called Nobody Listened. It hasn't opened yet in the States.
By the way, I co-directed it.
Co-directed. Okay,
co-directed
thank you for pointing
that
out.
Jorge Yula.
A Cuban emigre.
A Cuban emigre. Really born in Cuba, not like me.
Let's talk about black and white versus color. You have shot some movies in black and white, including My Night at Maud's.
Yes.
Of course, you started, unlike film history, which started in black and white and went to color, you started in color and did a few films in black and white.
Yeah.
Now, Wim Wenders, when I recently interviewed him, said that black and white is the most difficult thing
to shoot
and to develop. Do you agree with him?
Yes, it is very difficult because, it is difficult and it is easy. It has some easy aspects and some difficult. The easy one, I'll start by that, is that it's very elegant.
Yes.
You cannot be of bad taste in black and white. Everything looks correct. You see the worst movie of the 40s, which was in black and white, and there's always a basic elegance. I mean, things, they never have that gaudy aspect that bad movies have today, you know. Then the other problem that black and white has is that because of the lack of information of black and white, the lighting has to be like a painting. You have to be silhouetting things, singling out objects and things you want to see, because you see much less in black and white.
Because it's all shades of gray. There's
because
no colors to stand out.
There's very little to tell. People have to see what's happening with only black and white, whereas the other one, there's an infinite amount of colors which tell you different things. So you have to color. Black and white has to be much more refined, you know, and much more work if you really want to do something that people can recognize.
Since the labs don't have to process that anymore, do they know what they're doing?
That is one of the problems, too. That's why I don't like to do black and white today, because the results are always very poor. And those who have this obstination, like Woody Allen, for instance, of doing black and white, they bump into a wall. I mean, it just, what can you do? It's such an unusual thing. Labs don't know how to handle it anymore. And also cinematographers, us, we don't know how to do it anymore. It's an art perdu, lost art.
You know, you mentioned earlier that when you started working in movies, that you were the director and the cinematographer. You were directing the documentaries and you were shooting them too. Things have gotten very, very specialized, perhaps more so in America than in other countries.
Well, but on the other hand, that director-cinematographer figure, it still exists. There are still many directors of documentary. I believe the documentary should be done by the cinematographer. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, how can a director tell a cinematographer do that and do this? You know, there are always instant reactions that it's impossible to develop. So, no, there's still many people who do documentary and who are like an home orchestra. No?
Do you think things are too specialized? For instance, in America, you point out in your autobiography that the cinematographer can't run the camera.
Well, this is the legitimate Hollywood cinema unionized.
Mm-hmm.
But there is also in America, parallel to that, you know, non-union movies and movies made, thank God, you know, in the other way, in avant-garde and with little crews and lots of little money. That film we made, Nobody Listened, was made that way. It's a non-union movie with very little money and an incredibly small crew.
You've made nine movies with the late François Truffaut, and after Cuba went to France, and this was at the tail end of the French New Wave.
Or? Yes, in fact, I always have that image. Is that it's like if I got the last car of a train that was already speeding up.
How did that change you, seeing the French New Wave movies and then working with the French directors when you got there?
Well, I didn't work right away. I was, for 4 years, I was starving in Paris. I went back into teaching. It wasn't easy. And I didn't even have money to go to the movies. I skipped many of the movies of this early period because I couldn't afford it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a miracle, really, that I got to work with these people. And as I say, I got the last car, you know. Some people identify me with a new wave. In fact, I got into the middle of it, you know. I was lucky enough that I still got it.
But once you did start working as a cinematographer, how did what you were doing change you? I mean, what was different than what you had? Obviously, it was feature films, it was fiction film.
What I had done before?
The technique.
Not really, nothing. In fact, if what I brought into movies, if I have brought into movies, is my experience in documentary, because that's what I had done in Cuba. I did documentary with no lights, with available light. So when I did My Night at Maud and La Collectionneuse and The Wild Child, I use that technique. It's like they're like documentaries in a way.
Do you feel that many viewers think of the cinematographer too much as a technical person, part of the technical crew, as opposed to part of the artistic vision behind
yes,
the movie?
Yes, that's one of the mistakes. I think the schools, film schools, they always have those exams as to accept people, and they are always insisting in mathematics and chemistry and things like that, which really you use very little. If you are a cinematographer, unless you manufacture film and you go out to Kodak to work in laboratories, but otherwise, you don't really need that. And I think by doing that, they eliminate the people who are artistically inclined. And I think it's an art. I think it's an artistic activity. I don't know if it's an art, but it's an artistic activity, as being a cinematographer.
Your next movie is going to be with Martin Scorsese. What's I forget the title.
Well, for the moment being, it's called New York Stories. It's composed of three stories, each one directed by a different director, an omnibus movie, as they say. One is directed by Woody Allen, which is practically finished. The other one by Francis Ford Coppola, which is starting very soon. And the last one is Martin Scorsese, which is the one I'm going to do.
Have you worked with him before?
I did a little TV commercial in Italy for Giorgio Armani. And I admire him enormously. I think he's one of the greatest directors in America and in the world. So I consider myself very privileged that he called me.
Now, you choose your movies according to who's directing them. What specifically are you looking forward to about working with Scorsese?
Well, I praise style very much. You know, there are some good directors which I don't admire because they don't have a style. And Scorsese has a style. There's that nervousness, that New York electricity. And I think he has a style. He has a signature. I like to work with people who have a style, who have a universe of themselves.
Now, your style is somewhat international in that.
Oh, I don't have a style. No, I mean, I try not to have a style.
Uh-huh.
The problem is I don't succeed, but I try not to have a style. I try to adapt myself to every movie.
And you've done that in many different countries. Is it really different working from one? Let me ask you, let me put it this way. I have friends who tell me that their lives would change by going to Italy because the light is so beautiful. Is it true that the light is different in different countries, and does that affect your work?
Well, the light is the same everywhere, but it bounces differently against the architecture of Italy and the vegetation. That's what they mean. Of course, some countries have more clouds than others, but, I mean, sunlight is the same. No, but the look of the countries, of course, it does make a difference, but the world is shrinking, you know, I don't find any problem about moving from one country to another. On the contrary, it stimulates me. I like this change. Like I do, I like to do a big movie and then make a little one, and make a fiction film and then make a documentary. I like the alternate.
We only have a couple of seconds left, but what do you think are the movies that cinematography should be measured against, the greatest, the best shot movies that you've seen?
Well, I think that the films which have to do with common things, that's where you can measure a cinematographer. As I said before, films with landscapes, they're the ones that pay the most, but they're not how you should measure a cinematographer. See a normal day, everyday film, and that's it.
Well, I really regret we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for joining us. My guest has been cinematographer Nestor Almendros. His new documentary on human rights violations in Cuba is titled Nobody Listened. He's also the author of an autobiography titled A Man with a Camera. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Marty Moscoen will guest host tomorrow's program, and she'll speak with William Friedkin, director of the films The French Connection, The Exorcist, and a new made-for-TV movie called Cat Squad. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Milton Chester Milo Dragovich doesn't sound like the hero of a detective novel, and Montana doesn't sound like the setting for hard-boiled fiction. Coming up, James Crumley explains why they work for him. Crumley's fiction has earned him comparisons with Ross McDonald and Raymond Chandler. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles the Velvet Underground. The band was sponsored by Andy Warhol, but they were reviled by the hippie counterculture. And book critic John Leonard reviews Children of the Arbat by the Russian writer Anatoly Rybakov. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. President Reagan today refused to deny reports that he is willing to drop drug charges against Panamanian leader Manuel Noriega. In a brief news conference at the White House, the president also repeated his support for Attorney General Edwin Meese, and he spoke out on astrology. More from NPR's Brian Naylor.
The president, saying negotiations are going on right now, refused to comment on the substance of his administration's talks with Noriega, saying when you're negotiating, you don't talk. But he refused to rule out dropping the drug charges against Noriega in return for Noriega's stepping down.
There has been no decision made on some of the things that are being discussed. And I have to say that I think that much of what many of you have been dealing with as a story is based on some kind of leaks or misinformation.
The president said he has complete confidence in Attorney General Edwin Meese, whose resignation was called for today by the Washington Times, a newspaper that usually reflects the administration's conservative views. And in response to allegations in former Chief of Staff Donald Regan's book, the president said he does not guide his life by astrology and denied Regan's charge that the timing of the INF signing ceremony with General Secretary Gorbachev last December was influenced by the stars. I'm Brian Naylor at the White House.
Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres today met with President Reagan at the White House to discuss the Soviet role in the Mideast peace process. Afterwards, Peres told reporters that he believes Moscow will sign on to the U.S. Middle East peace plan at the forthcoming Reagan-Gorbachev summit. As for Israel, Peres said the Jewish state will continue to seek peace in the region.
I'm convinced that we can negotiate the difficulties, and my impression is that the United States and the administration is determined to continue the peace momentum, and so are we.
Peres was warmly welcomed at the White House. That's a sharp contrast to the mood that surrounded the visit in March of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir. He has rejected most elements of the U.S. peace plan. Today's Democratic primary in Oregon pits the momentum of Michael Dukakis against an all-out effort by Jesse Jackson to achieve a major upset. Jackson supporters believe a victory in Oregon could influence the outcome in California's primary next month. Alan Seporin of member station KLCC filed this report.
Most everyone agrees that it's Jesse Jackson who's generated voter enthusiasm in Oregon, but that doesn't necessarily indicate an upset victory. The belief that Dukakis is going to win the nomination anyway may be continuing his momentum. One couple, who between them seem indicative of most voters in the Democratic primary, split their votes.
I voted for Dukakis because I believe he's going to win the nomination, and I think he has the best chance of beating Bush.
I voted for Jackson. I think Jesse is for the, I mean, he's for the people. He's been there and kind of reminds me of Lincoln.
Officials are predicting a 50% voter turnout, and so far that appears to be the case. For National Public Radio, this is Alan Seporin in Eugene.
The U.S. trade deficit fell to $9.75 billion in March. The latest trade figure is the smallest in more than 3 years and about $4 billion less than February's deficit. The report from the Commerce Department showed that U.S. exports rose 23%, while imports were up about 3.5%. The news was a little too good for the stock market. Many investors saw the big jump in exports as a sign that the economy was overheating. Fears that a too robust economy would usher in higher inflation wiped away initial gains in both the bond market and the blue chip stock index, although the dollar managed to hang on to a good portion of its recent advances. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a profile of the Velvet Underground, a band that was largely ignored or detested in their own time, but 20 years after their last album, their music is generally regarded as prophetic.
The recent auction of Andy Warhol's belongings has drawn a lot of attention to him and reminded me that he was the godfather not only of pop art, but, ironically, of a lot of today's best rock and roll, thanks to his sponsorship of a band called the Velvet Underground.
$6 in my hand, up to Lexington, 125, feel sick and dirty, more dead than alive. I'm waiting for my man.
The Velvet Underground burst onto the scene at Warhol's Manhattan nightclub, the Exploding Plastic Inevitable, singing perverse songs about sex and drugs like Waiting for the Man, Heroin, and Venus in Furs. The main songwriter was a ghostly kid from Brooklyn named Lou Reed. The drummer was a woman, which was unheard of. There was a guy playing electric viola, and the iciest Germanic maiden in the world, Nico, who was listed as chanteuse, singing songs like I'll Be Your Mirror.
I'll be your mirror, reflect what you are, in case you don't know. I be the wind, the rain and the sunset, the light on your door to show that you're home. When you think the night has in your mind that inside you're twisted and unkind, let me stand to show that you're
arriving as they did at the height of the hippie era. The Velvet Underground upset and outraged everybody, which may have been the idea. When they played the Fillmore Auditorium in San Francisco, they were met with such an outpouring of bile and hatred that they probably wondered if they'd really come to the capital of peace and love. It didn't matter. In New York, they were loved by Warhol's Jet Set crowd, and they had a solid record deal with the jazz label, Verve. Nico left after their first album, and with the second, White Light, White Heat, they began making history. This was the album that featured the 17-minute masterpiece, Sister Ray, a relentless hard rocker with "Did he really say that?" lyrics that sealed the Velvet Underground's doom with hippies everywhere. On the other hand, it built the group a following in tough towns like New York, Detroit, and Los Angeles, where the squalor and decadence they sang about were facts of life. Still, they were hardly America's most popular band, and after White Light, White Heat, their violist, John Cale, quit to pursue being a serious composer. Adding a Bostonian named Doug Yule, they recorded a third album, simply entitled Velvet Underground, which promptly alienated what few fans they had. What was so perverse about this album was it was pretty.
Sometimes I feel so happy. Sometimes I feel so sad. Sometimes I feel so happy. But mostly you just make me mad. Baby, you just make me mad. Linger on your pale blue eyes. Linger on.
Songs like Pale Blue Eyes and Jesus revealed a side of this band nobody knew existed. But the audience of vicarious junkies and perverts they'd built up didn't want to know about it, and the audience that might have listened had already been scared off. The band said goodbye in 1970 with an album called Loaded, on which Lou Reed proved that he was Bob Dylan's equal on at least one song, Sweet Jane.
Standing on the corner, suitcase in my hand, Jackson's corset, Jane is in her vest, and me, I'm in a rock and roll band. Riding a Studs Bearcat Jim. You know, those were different times. All the poets, they studied rules of verse, and those ladies, they rolled their eyes.
But the band blew up, Reed went to England, and they were gone before nearly everybody knew how great they were. These days, it's hard to find a band that doesn't worship them or do Sweet Jane as an encore. I guess the time's finally caught up with the Velvet Underground.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle.
Some people, they like to go out dancing. And other people say have to work, just watch me now. And there's even some evil mothers. Well, they're gonna tell you that everything is just dirt. You know that women never really faint, and that villains always blink their eyes. Ooh. And that, you know, children are the only ones who blush, and that life is just to die.
This is Fresh Air. James Crumley is a novelist who's found a cult following for the tough yet sentimental characters in his detective fiction. Until recently, his novels have been hard to find, but gradually his books are being reissued as part of the Vintage Contemporary Fiction series. Crumley sets his detective stories in Montana, where he lives. The main character in Dancing Bear and The Wrong Case is Milton Chester Milo Dragovich III, Milo to his friends. He's an ex-deputy sheriff turned private eye who's drunk and broke a lot of the time as he waits to inherit the family fortune. I asked James Crumley why he started writing detective novels.
I like the notion of being able to deal in some kind of murky world where the morality is not too clearly delineated, and but where there's some kind of sense of justice that you can reach at the end. It's usually an uncomfortable and certainly unsatisfying sense of justice, but it satisfies me.
There are certain conventions of the detective genre. What are some of the advantages and disadvantages for you as a writer to be writing within a genre?
I find more disadvantages than advantages. You know, with the detective having to always be upright and forthright and honest and stern and steadfast and all of those things. And I think I've tried in all of the books to use a detective that's flawed in many of the same ways that the villains are flawed. And I think he even says occasionally that if he hadn't have been a cop, that he would have probably been a criminal. And I guess the only real advantage to writing in a genre is that you can play off the genre. It's like everybody knows the rules, and so that you can do pretty much whatever you want to, as long as you admit the rules, you can break them.
I'm going to ask you to read a passage from the beginning of The Wrong Case.
Okay, that's a sort of a tradition for the detective to sit around his office and describe it so that the people, so that the readers can get a sense of him. And this is Milton Chester Milo Dragovich is the third. This is his office. The large old-fashioned safe in the corner left from my grandfather's days as a banker was empty except for $2,000 of untaxed mad money. Age and sorrow, those were my only assets, my largest liabilities. But like most men who drink too much, I'd spent most of my life considering my dismal future, and it had stopped amusing me. So I had another drink and walked over to the north windows to look down upon the happy, employed folk of Merriweather. Once we Milo Dragoviches had been big stuff in this town, but now the only way I could look down on anybody was to climb up to my office, stare down from the windows. Lunch hour was done. People were hurrying about their business, driving back to office and store in air-conditioned cars, even though the air seemed more like spring than summer. I'd never owned an air-conditioned car, so I could feel vaguely smug, until August anyway.
Now, usually in detective novels, the characters' names are pretty short and simple. Philip Marlowe, Lou Archer. What did you do a Milo Dragovich for your detective?
It was a name that I'd run across. It's an old Montana name. And it's just stuck in my head. I couldn't get rid of it. And I think the newer detective novelists are getting away from the one-syllable easy names or the two-syllable names that have some sort of symbolic background to them. I just like the sound of the name. And, Milton Chester Milo Dragovich III.
Your detective says that he realized if he wasn't a cop, he'd probably be a crook. Mm-hmm. Now, you're a writer who spends a lot of time at a desk, probably behind a typewriter, or at least with a pad on your lap. Do you feel at all drawn to that world of crooks and cops?
Well, yes. In some kinds of ways, too, I'm a child of the 60s, when everybody was a criminal, partially because of the marijuana laws and partially because of the politics and the protests. I know a lot of minor league criminals, I guess you could call them, and I have friends with several cops and ex-cops, and even know a few private detectives. So I find that world much more interesting, for instance, say, than the academic world, where I labored for 11 years at various universities all across the country. I think all writers feel in some kind of way outside of the mainstream of the worlds they live in. And I think most writers find themselves drawn to other people who are on the outside looking in. So I'm not sure whether it's a fascination with crime or whether it's a fascination with alienation.
I wonder if it's a fascination with language also. Because both cops and criminals tend to have their own languages,
mm-hmm.
their own slang.
I have to admit I got into writing because I like the way words sound. And that was the first thing that moved me when I first started writing when I was very young. It was a long time before I did it seriously, but just the way the words sound has always... I started off as a poet. They suggested that I try prose. and I get some of the best advice I'd ever gotten.
How did you discover detective fiction?
underneath one of my aunt's mattresses when I was about when I was about 9 years old. And the first
was it supposed to be dirty?
Well, it was Mickey Spillane, and it was pretty racy stuff for high school girls back then. I was still in grade school, and my aunts must have hid them for some reason. And so I read Mickey Spillane at an early age. And it wasn't until I was in the middle of my first novel that I went back to detective novels. A poet here in Montana, Richard Hugo, turned me on to Raymond Chandler. And I spent a summer working on my first novel in Mexico and reading all of Raymond Chandler's work, which is when I decided that I wanted to do at least one detective novel.
You grew up in Texas, and mm-hmm. you now live in Montana. So you've spent most of your life in the West. Did you grow up with a lot of cowboy stories, westerns, things like that?
My great-grandfather was still alive when I was a little boy right after World War II, and he was one of the last of the Texas trail drivers and wagon train drivers to die. And so I picked up a lot of stories from him. My father worked in the oil field, however, and I grew up in company houses. And I read probably as much Western fiction when I was young as I did anything else except for science fiction. So I also went to the Western movies every Saturday while my mother was at the grocery store, go to a double feature at the It Theater in Mathis, Texas. And so I got all that cowboy stuff pretty good.
Any connection, you think, between that and your interest in detectives?
I'm certain there is. In some kinds of ways, I'm not sure whether it's the Western novels are like detective novels set in the West or whether detective novels are like Westerns. But there has to be some sort of connection between the gunfighter and the detective.
Your novels are just republished now in the Vintage Contemporary series. And I wonder if you think you're being rediscovered by new readers or publishers?
I don't remember being discovered the first time. So it's difficult to be rediscovered. It's nice to get to a broader kind of audience than people who go looking for my books. And I think they've given me a little more clout in the literary world, if one needs clout in the literary world, to be in this series with the writers who are considered serious writers, Tom McGuane, Ray Carver, etc. But sometimes I wish I was in the smaller paperback editions and more widely distributed in truck stops and supermarkets and 7-Elevens.
With nice lurid covers?
Absolutely. I think that's where my audience. I think that's where my audience is. One of the things that has always encouraged me and made me feel good about the books that I write is that working class people read them and are moved by them. My background is firmly rooted in the lower middle classes, working classes, and I still remember what work was like, although I'm certainly glad I don't have to do it anymore. I do have a great deal of respect for those people. And when they like my books, I'm particularly tickled.
James Crumley, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
James Crumley is the author of The Last Good Kiss, Dancing Bear, The Wrong Case, and One to Count Cadence. He spoke to us from KUFM in Missoula, Montana. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
Welcome back. You've been in Czechoslovakia for the past couple of weeks.
Yes, it'll be still a few days before the reports that we were over there preparing are on the air in anticipation of the summit. But we do have some news this evening.
What
about,
is it?
For one thing, the U.S. trade deficit's a little bit reduced this month, according to the figures released today by the Department of Commerce. We have a report from France on May 1968, remembered 20 years ago, as you may recall, the great strikes and demonstrations took place that eventually ended the rule of President Charles de Gaulle. Also, a talk with David Cote, whose book Year of the Barricades is about events in 1968 the world over.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Book critic John Leonard has a review of Children of the Arbat, a novel by the Soviet author Anatoly Rybakov. It's about love and politics in the time of Stalin. The book has a complex political history of its own.
The 77-year-old Soviet novelist Anatoly Rybakov spent 3 decades thinking about his own stint in the early 1930s in a Siberian labor camp before writing this autobiographical novel. And then he had to wait another 20 years to see it published. The literary magazine Novy Mir promised to publish it in 1967, and so did the literary magazine October in 1979. Finally, it was serialized a year ago in a third journal with a smaller circulation. It arrives in the West at last, courtesy of Glasnost, with a blurb from that tireless publicist of the permissible, Yevgeny Yevtushenko, and it rather creaks. The Arbat is the intellectual and artistic bohemian quarter of Moscow. Its children are students in 1933 and 1934, on the eve of Stalin's purges. These young students, the Komsomol Boy Scout Sasha, the ferociously romantic Varya, Lena the Weepy, Military Max, Vika in her silk underwear, Yuri of the secret police, are about to disappear into terror and silence. So will the old Bolsheviks in the Politburo, technocrats on the pig iron front, an entire generation of brilliant writers, and Mother Russia herself. By switching back and forth from the minds of the students to the mind of Stalin, Ribbikov wants us to understand how it all happened. It was all Stalin's fault, he says. 5'3", with bad teeth and a Jewish dentist, loving Charlie Chaplin and hating everybody else, Ribbikov's paranoid Stalin is a sort of cabbage patch monster of morbid suspiciousness, seething social resentments, and a not very interesting Georgian inferiority complex. This one-man devil theory of historical cataclysm just won't wash. It may be that any remotely adequate explanation of Joseph Stalin would need a Dostoevsky for the abnormal psychology, a Kafka for the atmospherics, and a Trotsky for the vivid historical detail. For not being any of these writers, Ribbikov can't be blamed. But of much more consequence is the fact that Stalin had a lot of help getting rid of almost 25 million people in the purges and the Great Terror, in the camps and in the famines. There were literally tens of thousands in the service of his paranoia, an enormous population of mechanics in his ministries of death, and Ribbikov cannot even bring himself to mention them. We spend some time with the luckless Sasha in Siberia, where he talks to bears and kulaks and thinks about Varya, and with Varya in Moscow, where she learns about architecture and breadlines and the meaning of love, and in the inner councils of the Kremlin, as the plot is hatched to murder Kirov and start the bloodbath. But it all reads more like such dreary classics of socialist realism as Ostrovsky's How the Steel Was Tempered and Gladhoff's Cement than anything by Bulgakov or Babel or Mandelstam, all of whom perished. One longs throughout a very long novel for the voice of Pasternak or Akhmatova or Eugenia Ginsburg, the savagery of Solzhenitsyn, even a Voinovich guffaw. What we get instead is earnest, well-meaning, naive, all too forgiving, tin-eared and pedestrian.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed Children of the Arbat by Anatoly Ribbikov. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, we'll hear from Alan Beck, a leading authority on how pets and their owners interact. He'll explain why it is that pets can lower their owners' high blood pressure and speed their recovery from heart surgery. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review the cast recording of the opera Nixon in China with a score by composer John Adams. And blues singer and retired truck driver Moses Rasko will sing the St. Louis Blues. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landrell. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.